Luke 6
is where we're going to study tonight, the first 19 verses or so. But I want to back up and pick up some of the thoughts from the end of chapter 5. We had a reception at Levi's house. And Levi, remember, in verse 28, just got up from his tax collecting booth and left everything and started following Jesus. Gave a reception. And I didn't notice this and didn't call it to your attention, so I wanted to go back and just pick it up by way of review. That in verse 30, it says the scribes and the Pharisees and their scribes grumbled about what Jesus was doing. But did you notice? And I didn't point this out. They grumbled to the disciples. They started complaining to the disciples about what Jesus was doing. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, were they not a thought, but just a kind of a question? Were they afraid to confront Jesus?
You know, that's the flip side of the coin I was looking at, that maybe by confronting Jesus' disciples, they would find a weak link or a weak niche.
But they'd already been shut down a couple times by Jesus.
Yeah. And so Jesus answered them. So the thing that struck me there is here, somebody's messing with his disciples, maybe putting them on the spot. Maybe they don't, you know, like there was that debate last night. Maybe somebody doesn't know how to answer the question that was posed to them. They hem and haw around. So Jesus just stepped in and said, it's not the healthy that need to be fixed. It's the sinners. And so then they said it to him there in verse 33. John's disciples fast frequently and make supplications, and those of the Pharisees as well, but yours eat and drink. So they're picking on, hello, Candy. Picking on Jesus' disciples. Jesus steps up to bat for them, and then they accost him. Of course, he's got answers that they can't handle. First of all, he says, answer number one, it's not possible for the bridegroom and the friends of the bridegroom to be morose when the wedding's about to take place. Okay? And so it would be inappropriate for my disciples to fast and mourn, because it's an exciting time. And then in verse 36, you have the new garment, old garment, and 37, old wineskin, new wineskin. And what Jesus is saying there, as I understand it, is it's totally inappropriate when we have, if these guys knew the Old Testament at all, a wedding meant a what? A new covenant. See, a wedding meant a new covenant. They knew a new covenant was coming, and Jesus referred to himself as the bridegroom. Jeremiah 31, verse 31 beginning, he talks about a new covenant. He says, I made them a covenant. My covenant, which they broke, although I was a husband to them. The covenant of Mount Sinai was a covenant of marriage between God and his people. Having a bridegroom and expecting a new covenant meant there's going to be a new covenant. And what they were doing is trying to patch their behavior, fix the old by cutting stuff out of the new and patching it on. He says, that's not going to work. In fact, he says, you get so accustomed to drinking the old wine, no one wishes for the new. We're used to the way we're doing things, and we don't want to change, is the way I took that. We don't want to change. And so that's why you're fussing with me. I'm bringing about the change that God promised would be there, and you don't want it. So any thoughts on that?
Just a quick one. When Jesus told him about the when he told him, how would you put it, that he's a doctor, for the sick. They didn't even address that. They changed the subject. You know, okay, that's when you know you've won.
And that, yeah, and but there's two thoughts on that. I'm glad you brought that up. There's two thoughts on that. These people are sick. That's why I'm here. Why aren't you here doing it? Oh, and by the way, you're sick too. You need me too. So,
Question.
yeah.
When the Pharisees were saying that he shouldn't be there, what were they doing there?
They were, how do I want to say this? They weren't coming to the feast and participating. They were there as Gestapo.
Yeah, they
Is
were
that a
looking
good
for
word?
something.
Police.
They were looking for accusations.
So they weren't participating in the.
No, they were just calling him out. They were there to find, get something, get their claws into it. And you try to get your claws into him, and he says, "You know, you guys think these are sinners. They need you. How come you're not here ministering to them? The sick need you," which is, in his way, a call for them to repent, to change. And it was, you know, right over their head.
Say,
All right.
Rod.
Yes.
Rod,
Yes, John.
another thought on this, the fact that Jesus was dining in the home of a tax collector would have been scandalous to a Pharisee.
Oh yeah. That qualified him as a sinner right there. Not Jesus, but the tax collector. Yeah.
Rod.
So, yeah. Yeah, Michael.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to that with the bridegroom. You can go back to Hosea. Where and as well as Jeremiah, where you know where the bridegroom he had left the building, you might say, but also that the divorce of what the covenant relationship with him was gone, it was nullified. There was no and
You
then
know, the divorce hasn't taken place yet. The divorce takes place at the in AD 70 at the destruction of the temple.
well, I thought okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, they were just separated then.
Well, you know
Separation.
what the Hebrews writer said in chapter 10, verse 9, he is taking away the first, that he might establish the second. And the second was the covenant of marriage. And so the taking away of the first is the divorce. So it
Yeah.
hadn't taken
Okay.
place during the ministry of Jesus.
Okay.
Okay. All righty. Chapter 6. Now, everybody in the building, I have a handout of some notes that I put together. Of course, I emailed it to all of you already too with a PDF file. So the people in the audience have it. I mean, in the Zoom audience, I have it available to them. And we here, sitting here, don't have our computers with us, but we have the paper in front of us. So chapter 6, what is Sabbath? Andy, do you know what Sabbath is? Get ready, Susan, because if Candy needs to help, you're the tag team. What is Sabbath? Good, Susan.
Day of rest. And
It,
you weren't supposed to do
succinctly,
anything.
succinctly,
Yeah.
a day of rest. But there, tell me more. Tell me more. What you know about Sabbath?
Seventh day of the week.
It was the seventh day of the
Saturday.
week, and so correspond to our Saturday, right? I find it interesting that the Seventh-day Adventists make a big point of referring to Sunday as the day of the sun god, and not recognizing that Saturday had something to do with Saturn. Anyway, tell me more. What about Sabbath?
That's when the people
Mm-hmm.
went to the temple. That's when the people went to the temple when.
Yeah, maybe they went to, maybe they said, well, let's go to synagogue on
Or
Sabbath.
synagogue, rather.
But when God ordained Sabbath, there was no synagogues to go to. You know, synagogue came about as a
Well,
an
yeah.
exile substitute for being able to go to the temple.
Okay, here we go. Yes. It was a part of the covenant that God made with the people of Israel and only with the people of Israel.
Yeah. An indication, he said, it is a sign between me and you that I am Yahweh who sets you apart. Okay. But Leviticus 23, verse 3, somebody have that? Read that for me. Leviticus 23:3. Now, Leviticus 23 is a chapter you want to remember because in that chapter are listed in consecutive order the five major feasts of Israel, beginning, with, of course, with
if they know it's God, we get this to work.
Say again? Work. Oh, Lynn's fussing with some stuff. Beginning with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and then going directly into Passover, and then the next would be the Feast of Pentecost, and then you'd have after that the Feast of Trumpets, and then the Feast of Booths, throughout the five that are in. But 23:3 says what? Lindy, got that real loud.
For 6 days, work may be done, but on the seventh day, there is a Sabbath of complete rest, a holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwellings.
Okay. Complete rest, no work. Define work. What is work? Now, we do know that there was the story of the young man who was out picking up sticks to build a fire on the Sabbath. What should we do? And Moses was told to stone him to death because he was picking up sticks on the Sabbath. Seems like a kind of a picayune, nitpicky, picking up sticks, nitpicky. Anyway, very serious to mess with God's Sabbath. Okay? What's work? What is work?
There's about a ton of Hasidic tradition trying to define what work is.
Okay. John put his finger on the soft spot, but Candy, you were saying something.
Well, I mean, they made it so that they weren't doing big meals and stuff like that.
Yeah. Meal prep had to take place the day before your... Everybody, I mean, if you read the Ten Commandments, the fourth commandment in Deuteronomy 20, starting say around verse 8, somewhere in there, everybody, your cattle, your slaves, your family, everybody got the day off every Saturday. They got the full day off.
So on the Sabbath, you don't have to make your bed.
You know, and this is the point that John made, that the Hasidic, that's the very, what's the word, very strict, there's another word.
The Pharisees were called the Hasidim.
Yeah, they're very Hasidic. Strict and according to rectitude, and I'm trying to. There's a word. Anyway, the very strict order of the Jews had just this bucket full, a suitcase full, a house full of little rules. Have you heard, for example, of a Sabbath day's journey?
Yeah, I
have. Okay. That's not in the law. That's in the tradition. What's a Sabbath day journey? That's as far as you can go on a Sabbath day without working. Okay, if you go any further, then it's considered work. Now, there's in your notes, there's this very silly, and so I chose this one because it was so silly. But the ancient rabbis taught that on Sabbath, one was forbidden to tie a knot. Now, back in 30 years ago, this happened. There was an apartment building that caught on fire, and the kosher Jews that lived there asked their rabbi, is it okay if we call the fire department, because if we use our phone, that's work. 20 minutes later, the rabbi decided it was okay. By then, the building had burned down. Okay, so we can't work. We can't even make a phone call. This one, however, you can't tie a knot. Except a woman could tie a knot if it was to secure her girdle. Okay?
Rod?
So if a bucket of water had to be raised from a well, I don't know why that wasn't considered work right there, lifting a bucket of water out of the well. One could not tie a rope to the bucket. But a woman could tie her girdle to the bucket and then to the rope. I mean, that's how nitpicky and
silly.
I mean, just absolutely inane. They were about the Sabbath. So there's just this. He's going through the Sabbath, and then we're gonna. So you can't work. Go ahead.
There were jobs where they absolutely had to milk cows. You can't skip a day milking a cow; they'll die. You know.
Yeah.
Circumcision.
Yeah. And in fact, in Matthew, I think it's 12, Jesus deals with those very points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, priests circumcise babies; they have to do it on the eighth day. And if the eighth day after the baby's birth falls on a Sabbath, the priest will violate the Sabbath law by doing this operation, which, you know, is the silliness of it. But let's watch how Jesus dealt with this in two separate situations. First of all, it happened on a Sabbath as he passed through standing grain that his disciples were plucking and eating heads of wheat, rubbing them in their hands. Now, in Deuteronomy 23, verse 25, this was entirely permissible. This was not stealing. You could pass through or pass by your neighbor's field and pluck the grain. You couldn't harvest it. I mean, you couldn't take a basket in with you and cut enough to go home and feed your family. But as you're walking through, you could take a handful of grain, rub it in your, blow the chaff off, pop it in your mouth, and eat or chew on it. Have you ever done that? Chew on wheat until it became like gum in your mouth? That's the gluten in it. Anyway, they would do that. But the disciples, the Pharisees said, verse 2, why are you doing what is not allowed on a Sabbath? Now, what was it that wasn't allowed?
They were working.
They were
thrashing.
Well, before they were thrashing, they were harvesting.
Picking.
They were harvesting and thrashing and winnowing and food prep. Four separate violations of the Sabbath just by fucking with the hand. Okay? That gives you a sense of how, what's the word I'm looking for now? How sacred and sacrosanct the Sabbath was. And why in the writings of Paul, for example, even out in the Gentile countries, the Jews were insistent that anybody converted to Christ had to keep the laws of Moses, had to circumcise their kids and keep the laws of Moses or they couldn't be saved. It was a very sacrosanct thing. No one who drinks the old wants the new, Jesus said at the end of the last chapter. So why are you doing what is not allowed on the Sabbath? You're reaping and threshing and winnowing and preparing food. And he answered, okay, I'm going to stop right there. When Jesus was tempted by Satan three different times, how did Jesus respond every single time?
It is written.
An appeal to what has already been written. And I want you to think about that seriously. Paul said in Romans 15 at verse 4, whatever was written before times was written for our admonition, that through the comfort and patience of the scriptures, we might have hope. These stories God chose to put there to illustrate how he deals with us, how he thinks about us, and how he behaves toward us. And so those scriptures are there for our encouragement. And so Jesus said in verse 3, did you never read this thing which David did when he was hungry? and those being with him. Did you never read that story? Now, what does that say? Did you never read? Candy, have you never read about the prodigal son? And she'll say, yeah, I've read about him. And so Jesus is saying to these religious bigwigs, have you never read the story of David? Look at the gallows there. Mm. Now, suppose they had read the story of David. Suppose they had. Mm-hmm. They hadn't learned from it, had they? Mm-hmm. They hadn't learned what it's like to walk with God. Mm. Is it all these strict rules that actually sometimes work to the detriment of God's children? Or are those rules guidelines that there are things that are supersede them? Like, for example, keep the Sabbath. Don't work on the Sabbath. But if you got a baby, we circumcise on the Sabbath. If your animal falls in the ditch on the Sabbath, you don't wait till the next day to pull him out. See, there are things that...
What if a baby's born on the Sabbath?
Then the next Sabbath he'll be circumcised.
That's work.
What do you call it, work?
Labor.
Labor. There you go. I knew someone to come up with that. Okay. And so they got these stupid things like, if you don't do this, God's going to zap you type of attitude. Did you never read this thing which David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered in. Where would you find this story, by the way? Now, when Jesus said, did you never read? That implies it can be read.
Yeah. Samuel.
1 Samuel 21. You'll find it in this story. Briefly, in 1 Samuel 21, David was fleeing for his life from Saul. And they got out of town and didn't have food or weaponry. So they stopped at the tabernacle and asked the priest, do you have anything here? And all he had was the showbread, the bread of the presence.
Goliath's sword.
And Goliath's sword, but the bread of the presence, which, first of all, because it was the bread of the presence and he had it available, how often did they change out that bread? You know, in the tabernacle, there were three. There was the candlestick, the table of the showbread, and the altar of incense. Okay. And they, every day they would refill the oil in the candles, keep them burning. What about the table with the bread? There were 12 loaves, one for each tribe. How often would they change that out?
I think of it daily.
Every Sabbath.
Oh.
Every Sabbath. You can read that over in Leviticus 24. 5-9, every Sabbath they would change that out. So David probably came to the tabernacle on a Sabbath and was given this. That's the only bread that was available. And who was to eat that bread? Only the priests. And yet David ate it and was guiltless. Why?
Because that's all there was.
Because there was human need.
Priority.
Yes, the priority. The compassion. Go, I think in the Matthew text of this story, Jesus said, go read what this means. I desire compassion, not sacrifice. God wanted compassion. So
is there any place about,
say again?
Is there any place that says only the priest may eat that, or is that for the priests? And once it's used, the priest can neither consume it or dispose of it as at his will.
That would fly in the face. I don't know the answer to your question off the top of my head, John, but I do know that that if it's holy food, it would be defiled by a stranger eating it. And so I would be willing to bet a dollar to a donut that it was only for the priests.
Yeah. Well, the reason I asked that is the priest imposed a stipulation that the young men who consumed that could not have been with a woman.
Yeah.
Recently, and there's nothing in the law about that.
Right. I don't want to dig deep into that because of time constraints, but I do want to point out that the fact that David was permitted without guilt to eat that, and they didn't get that, See, that's the main point. Have you not read? And so there's this, the effect that Jesus' question had on them implied that they were either ignorant of the text or hadn't processed what the text meant relative relationship with God. They didn't know the heart of God, that human need is more important than religious ritual. Linda, you had a thought?
Well, just that Jesus said it was for the priests alone.
Oh, okay. If Jesus said it was for the priests alone, then that must be what it was.
Yep.
What is not permitted for any to eat except the priest, there in verse 4. I don't think Jesus missed that one.
So, well, did he miss that one? Or is he saying, hey, Pharisees, this is your tradition. You won't allow it to be for the priests alone. Well, there are other places where he's quoted things, you know, talking about things which are unlawful, which are actually against the tradition.
You may be right, but he didn't say that. He didn't say it that way. Anyway, pressing on, keeping the key point in mind, that if they knew the scriptures and they knew God's heart, they wouldn't be like this toward guys just eating a snack as they walked. Okay? They were more concerned and picayune about their traditions than they were about human need. Now, that is followed by another Sabbath story. It happened on another Sabbath that he entered into the synagogue to teach. Now, here on the first Sabbath, they're just walking through the field, passing through the standing grain. I wonder if it was only 3/4 of a mile that they went. Didn't even talk about that. But now he's going into the synagogue to teach. Interesting, isn't it? I'm not just going in as a visitor to hear what the preacher has to say. I'm going in to teach. There's things that people need to hear from me. And there was a man there whose right hand was shriveled. All right. So, I passed over something really important. Verse 5. See, verse 3 has Jesus' first response. You don't know the heart of God relative to what the Sabbath was. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Okay? And then, but the second thing is, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. Tell me about that. When Jesus said, the Lord of the Sabbath is the Son of Man, what's he saying? Susan, what do you think that, what does that mean to you? The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Who made the Sabbath?
He wrote it. He ought to know what it means.
He did that. And he ought to know what all is involved in the Sabbath.
Yeah. If he's Lord of the Sabbath, he ought to know. I mean, this is my thing. I know what the rules for this are. Okay. And that would be the, maybe, you know, the what am I trying to say? That would be, there's a couple layers here. Mm-hmm. That would be the layer of, okay, I know what I'm talking about. But when he says, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath, what else is he really saying?
It's, I make the rules. That they did not get the reaction that they did when he said, I'm coming on the clouds.
Yeah. And Jim said, I make the rules. That's kind of what we've been saying. But is he not really claiming to be divine?
Yes.
No, I mean, that's, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath.
I feel like he's saying, who are you to tell me?
Oh, absolutely.
I already know this.
I mean, you didn't listen to the scriptures, and now you're not listening to the one who made the Sabbath. You see, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. I made the Sabbath. But you go back to Genesis 1, chapter 2, God rested on the seventh day. And call it, and that's why in Exodus 20, he says, that's what I want you to do. I want you to rest on the seventh day, just like I did. And then in Deuteronomy 5, the reason they rested is to remember that they had been slaves in Egypt. And the reason they rested once every 7 days is because that's when God rested. They're delivered. But I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. Okay. Right. And I just wonder how that made them feel, because there's no mention of them responding to that here, but that may follow into this next story. Okay. Michael, were you just about to say something?
Yeah, he's also ascribing himself as the Son of Man, which should give him give them a. It's like he keeps dropping these little hints to
them. Yeah, he's not shy about saying what needs to be said, and he's not worried about the consequences of saying it, is he? So that takes us into this next story. He enters the synagogue. There's a man there whose right hand was shriveled. I wonder if he was a shill, that if he was a plant by the Pharisees. Let's see what he's going to do. Now, maybe they just took advantage of the fact that he was there, or maybe they put him there. I don't know. I can't say that that's the case. But verse 7 says, the scribes and the Pharisees watched closely. Now, what happens when you watch closely? Now, what's the implication? They watched closely if he might heal on the Sabbath in order to find some kind of charge to bring against.
They're waiting for to say, aha, we gotcha.
Yeah, they're not in a mindset of, well, let's see what the truth is here. They're in a mindset of, let's see if we can find something we can get him on. Yeah, it's a gotcha moment. Okay, so in order then that might bring charges against it, but he knew their reasonings. Verse 8. So, and he's, now he knew their reason. He knew what they were up to. He knew that they were trying to get something on it. So he backed down.
No, just like what he did with the woman, exactly the same as the woman in adultery, the caught in adultery.
Yeah.
They brought her in. Just for I gotcha.
Yeah, and that's the thing I want us to learn. Not to be ashamed of the truth that we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And not to be afraid of the consequences of saying this is the truth. Say, here's Jesus. They're looking to nail him on something. He knew that they were looking to nail him on something. So he said to the man with the shriveled hand, anyway, spoke to him anyway. Rise up, stand in the middle. Rising up, he stood. So there he is. Now, stand up right there in the middle. What does that do to everybody in the synagogue?
And they still see.
Doesn't that become the focal point? I mean, this is not somewhere two guys whispering to each other over in the corner and, oh, my hand was healed. Stand up right there in the middle. And so he did. And then Jesus said to them, so he's got this guy standing. What do the scribes and Pharisees look like, do you suppose? You got to suppose, because it doesn't tell us. But we do know that they're watching closely to catch him in something. And now he's got this guy standing up. What kind of look is on their face?
They're probably wringing their hands.
or
doing the evil laugh.
I have seen people who thought they were in authority have that authority challenged, and they look angry. Like, how dare you challenge me? I don't know what's going on in their face, but whether they're salivating, wringing their hands, or glaring at him, saying, how dare you do this in our synagogue? You come from out of town, you tell this guy to stand up. It's our synagogue. I don't know what's going on, but I do know this. Jesus said to them, on the Sabbath, is it lawful to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy? How do you answer that question? Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil? Yeah, we're talking about what's lawful on the Sabbath, right? Is it lawful to do good or is it lawful to do evil? Is it lawful to save life or is it lawful to take life on the Sabbath? I mean, does it matter what day it's on? But did you notice? Is it lawful to take life on the Sabbath? Who was wanting to kill Jesus? They wanted to kill Jesus. They were wanting to take life. And he's saying, Okay, talk about lawful. Is it lawful to take life on the Sabbath? I mean, is there any work involved in stoning a man to death?
Yeah.
I mean, what size rocks do you have to use? Little pebble like for your pea shooter? Well, you got to use rocks that make maybe take two hands to lift. Is it lawful to take life on the Sabbath? Which is exactly what they want to do. And so really putting the screws to them here. And looking around at all of them, he said to him, stretch out your hand. Now, think about that, Candy. This guy's got to throw up a hand, and Jesus said, stretch it out. Immediate response might be, man, if only I could. I've been wanting to stretch out my hand all my life. But he just did. Jesus asked the man to do something he couldn't do. You ever pick up on that thought? He asked the man to do something he couldn't do. And the guy didn't balk and say, I can't do that. Never been able to. He just did it. You look like you want to say something.
It's kind of funny. What work did Jesus do there? Where's the calories expended, you know?
He could have done all that with his hands folded.
Exactly. There was no calories expended. Where's the work?
Yeah. Right. And so he did, and his hand was restored, but they were filled with what?
Rage.
Rage. Now, the Greek word is annoyus.
Annoyed.
Huh? No, not annoyed. They didn't have any brains about it. Ah is the negative, annoy it nooses the mind.
No
thought. They were insane. I translate it madness, insanity. Their brain just quit working. They weren't in such, and therefore madness or rage. And they discussed among themselves what should they do to Jesus. And he just asked him, tell me, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil? How do you suppose they answered that? And now he's put them in the spot where they're consulting with each other of what they're going to do to get. So those are the two Sabbath stories here in Luke 6. Yeah. Go ahead, Michael.
You'd asked about what you know, they were saying is, you know, they were the eminent authority of the law and scripture and stuff like that. And I think the thought of being defied by this man who was coming and teaching these new thoughts, they felt very betrayed by their authority over the people.
Well, that's the point I was trying to get at earlier. How did they feel? That they would, the look that they would have on their face when Jesus had that man stand up, a look of how dare you go against us? We're in charge here. So I think you're exactly right. Now, those are the two Sabbath stories. And now we get into the choosing of the 12. And so I'm going to ask this question. I'm asking this question of the ladies, okay? So all the men in the audience, whether online or in the audience here, let the ladies have first shot. What is the difference? In verse 21, he called out to his disciples and selected from them 12. These he also named apostles. What's the difference between a disciple and an apostle?
Well, a disciple is a learner.
Yeah, hence the word. Mm-hmm. What discipline did I study in college? I was chemical engineer. That was my discipline. A learner. Okay. Apostle means?
Witness.
They were the witnesses, but that's their job, but not what the word means. Okay. Apo is the Greek word for from, and stelo is the Greek word which means I send. So the apostle is one who's been sent. That's really what it means. And it carries the idea of official sent. The idea of ambassador. Let me read the notes here. The idea behind the ancient Greek word for apostle is ambassador. The Greek word means one sent. It describes someone who represents another person or another interest, like an entire country, for example. He does not speak for himself, but has a message from his sender, or the one who sent him. And so when we think of these guys as apostles, they would be official spokesmen for Jesus, the one who sent them. A disciple, and I think this is an important definition. A disciple is was a learner. I got this from Morris. A disciple is a learner, a student. That's the root idea of the word. But in the first century, a student did not simply study a subject. He followed a teacher. There's an element of personal attachment in disciple that is lacking in student. I mean, I studied several things when I went to the University of Washington, but I wasn't a disciple of any of the teachings. Okay? There was not I'm following him around so I can learn at his feet. But that's what a disciple is. That's who you are. Someone who follows with Jesus, so as to learn from Jesus the ways of life. So that's what we got going on. He went out to the mountain to pray, and he continued all night in prayer. And then when he got finished with the prayer, he called the disciples. How many were there? Multitudes, okay? And picked out of the multitudes 12, whom he called apostles, or named apostles. Now, here's an interesting. Why did he go up on the mountain? So he went up on a mountain.
Be alone.
To pray, to be alone. I put a note here to myself. Did he get better reception up on the mountain? Jonah prayed from the belly of the fish in the bottom of the Mediterranean. God can hear wherever you are, right? But he continued all night. Have you given thought to that? This prayer of Jesus, and he picked out 12 guys from all of his disciples, 12 of them he designated as his ambassadors. Paul even used that term, not apostle, but we are ambassadors for Christ. He used that term in one of his letters. And so what do you take? What do you make? What lesson do you learn? What picture do you have in your head of Jesus praying all night long? I mean, what's the longest you prayed before your eyes got so heavy you fell off to sleep? And what concerns on your heart are so heavy or so critical or important that you felt the need to keep talking about them? We know that Jesus condemned meaningless repetition, didn't he? In the Sermon on the Mount, he says, don't use meaningless repetition, saying something over and over and over and over again, just so God will hear you. He says, don't do that. So that's not what's going on here. But all night, I want you to think of the gravity of the choice. Who is he choosing? Ambassadors. To do what?
They were going to be the foundation of the new covenant.
Let's ask the question this way. Suppose that Jesus went his 3 years of ministry and had selected nobody to officially represent him, and then he died. What do you have?
A dead end.
You have a like a pool that had collected all kinds of information, but with no outlet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to dry up. These guys, I say it another way. Jesus' message of salvation and his ability to take it to the world stopped at the cross. He couldn't go any further than that. That was the end of it. What did he say? One of the seven sayings? It is finished. He was done. But the message was just starting. These guys were carrying the same heaven-sent message that Jesus came from heaven to bring. They're carrying it out to the world. He's praying all night long about that. He's praying all night. And then when he finished praying, he chose the 12, named them apostles. There was Peter and Andrew, his brother James and John, Philip and Bartholomew. It's interesting that that he lists them in pairs. And I wonder, is that because he sent them out in pairs? I don't know. I don't know that these are the pairs he sent them out in. Matthew and Thomas, James of Alphaeus, and Simon, who is called Zealot. Why would they call him Zealot, do you suppose? I can think of two reasons. One, that he might have been of the sect of the Zealots. There were several Jewish sects, and the Zealots was one of them. Maybe he was just passionate. Because Zealot means what?
Zeal.
Full of zeal, on fire. El fuego, we'd say in Spanish. You say that, Nick? El fuego? On fire. Okay.
They're Portuguese.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm my bad. Brazil is Portuguese. Judas of James and Judas Iscariot, who became a betrayer. Okay, Candy, tell me, why did Jesus pick a betrayer? Was he duped? I mean, he prayed all night long, and then he picked a fella who would betray him. Thoughts on that, anybody?
And steal from the money.
Yeah, he was a thief. Now, were these things hidden from Jesus? What's that phrase you use, Scott? I think not. There's a passage. I wrote it down somewhere that I wanted to share with you. And I think I'm not going to find it. This is John 13. Jesus is at the Last Supper with his disciples, his apostles. He said, I know, if you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. I'm verse 18. I do not speak of all of you. I know the ones I have chosen. But that the scripture may be fulfilled, he who eats my bread has lifted up his heel against me. From now on, I'm telling you before it comes to pass, so that when it occurs, you may believe that I am. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send, sin receives me. Anyway, Jesus was warning them, one of you is going to betray me, and I know who it is. And I know from the beginning that you would do that. But I'm telling the rest of you right now so that when it happens, you won't be so shocked and surprised. You say, wow, that guy slipped that past Jesus? If that guy can slip it past Jesus, anybody can, right? So I'm telling you ahead of time that one of you is going to be betraying me, and I know that that's going to happen. So whatever you come up with, why did Jesus pick a betrayer? We learn from John 13. Somebody is going to betray me. That's going to fulfill scripture. Did Jesus try to keep that from happening? Did he work with Judas? Johnny asked the question Sunday morning, and I really didn't quite address it completely. How must Jesus have felt when Judas betrayed him, having spent 3 years in close fellowship with him, and then to be betrayed by that friend? In fact, in the garden, Jesus said, friend, do you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? I think Jesus worked and worked to present to Judas a better way. But he knew, I guess, bottom line, he knew who he was. So he came back down, verse 17. After he descended with them, he stood on a level place, a broad plain, along with a great multitude of his disciples and a large number of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and from the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon. I don't know if you have a picture in your head of a map. I kind of do. I can see Jesus up on the coast of the Sea of Galilee, and I don't know west or east, but I'm guessing on the east coast of the Sea of Galilee. And there's Sidon way on the due west of him out on the Mediterranean, and there's Judea due south of him. And we're talking a good number of miles, 70, 80 miles probably from where this took place down to the southern border of Judah. People coming from great distances is what I'm getting at, and from all over the territory to hear him and to be healed from their maladies. And those being troubled with unclean spirits were being made well. And the entire multitude sought to lay hold of him, because power proceeded from him and all were healed. This was an amazing time for them. But I want you to think, what was the drawing power? What brought them to Jesus? Was it the great message of the new covenant? All those who drank from the old are satisfied with it. They said they're not interested in new. It's good enough. Or was it that they wanted, I just want to be physically well. Did they want to be spiritually well? Or were they satisfied with their spiritual state and want simply to be physically well? Think about what's important to you. The physical health and well-being, you got money in the bank and a nice comfortable place, or that you're walking with Jesus and hearing his message. So he brought his disciples down, his apostles, and introduced them to the multitudes. These are the guys you're going to be working with. Any thoughts?
Rod? Michael has one?
Yeah.
Okay. Wasn't there a heightened messianic expectation at this period of time, since this was the fourth kingdom, like of the metal man in Daniel 2, as well as other things, that ability for one to do these things had not been done for hundreds of years, and the Spirit of God was going to be coming upon him and stuff like that. So they were seeing all these signs and wonders and miracles and everything, and seeing that God was with them again.
Well, you know, we made that point back at the birth of John, didn't we? Where everybody was in heightened expectation, what will this child become? And you're right about the timing. You go to Daniel 9, for example, the 70 weeks of Daniel 9, where it's laid out of what it's going to be. Messiah would come, and then the city would be destroyed, and there was a period of time. So yeah, there was a strong messianic expectation. You go to the book of Acts, and tells you about people who had raised up to try to draw disciples after them. Jesus in Matthew 24 says, there are going to be a lot of people claiming to be the Christ. Don't follow them. So yes, there was a huge messianic expectation at this time. But I want to focus in on something else that you said, and I'm glad you said it, because it escaped my mind as we went through. I even got it written in my notes, and I didn't look at them. But good, a lot of good it does make notes, huh? But I put down there MSW, or MWS. Miracle, wonder, sign. Miracle, wonder, and sign. And three descriptive terms that are used of the same event. It's called a miracle because it's a mighty work. The Greek word is dunamis, out of which we get dynamite. Powerful work. Okay. It's called a wonder because the impact it has on the observers. Wow! It's called a sign because what it indicates. Okay? So what was it like in the synagogue? Go back to the second Sabbath question. What was it like in the synagogue when Jesus said, stand in the middle? And he got up and stood in the middle. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to take life. And then he said, stretch out your hand. And he stretched out his hand. Everybody was staring at him, and his hand was good as new. A miracle. But what was the response?
There was no wonder.
There was anger rather than wonder, right? Why was there anger and not wonder?
Because they didn't read the sign.
Well, yes and no. It's because the old is good enough, and we don't want it. We don't want to change. We like what we like it the way it is, and we don't want to have to change. Take that miracle away. What was it that they said in Acts 4? That a noteworthy miracle has taken place is apparent to all Jerusalem. We can't deny it, but so that it spread no further, tell them to quit speaking about it. They didn't want the change. They saw it, but they got angry because it meant they would have to change if they became amazed at it. Now, the multitudes were amazed. All right. Our time is up. I looked at 1 through 19 and said, man, that's gonna be a breeze to get through all that. We might get out of here 10 minutes early.
Rod,
you guys talk too much. Yes, Michael?
The context up in earlier in 6 through 11, wasn't the point of the context the scribes and the Pharisees, the emphasis on them as the ones that were watching? And who he was really trying to show forth, were they the ones that were the anger? They were the ones that were angry and that, like, they were being overshadowed.
Yeah, I think that's the point we were trying to make. The multitudes were amazed, but the scribes and Pharisees were angry because it wasn't, it was requiring them. And I think I connect it again back to the last of chapter 5, the old is good enough. We don't want the new. Okay? Okay, well, let us call it to a close at this point.